I would like to welcome you to join me for an interview that I had with Robert Haas, our former United States Poet Laureate and a Pulitzer winner as well. This was one of my first interviews when I had just started off podcasting, and I guess I was probably a year into it, so I was thrilled to talk to him. At that time, I was only inviting guests to the show who had influenced my life dramatically, and Robert Haas was one of those people. I'd had the pleasure of hearing him speak twice. Each time, the audiences, the auditoriums were packed. It was standing room only, literally, because there were people standing and sitting on the floors. Everyone just wanted to be in his presence because of his authenticity and his deep connectedness to his work. It's been a couple years now since this conversation, but it still stands as one of my favorites. I was honored to also have my mom join me that day. She is the host of a book site called Books So Many Books with about 14,000 passionate book lovers. And it was a pleasure to have her there as well. I hope you enjoy listening to this talk as much as I enjoyed having it. Now, what is the weather like down there in Berkeley today? Because I want to live vicariously through you.
Well, it's bright and sunny and cold. It's probably 48 or 50 degrees, sunshine. I live in the hills north of the university. My study window looks out onto a hillside street, old sycamore that's still bare. Across the street is a wall of weeds from the neighbor on the uphill side who doesn't sweat gardens. but there is I can see from here one small, looks like a periwinkle, and some clovers that are beginning to produce sorrel. So the first signs of spring are happening here.
Oh, no way.
We're a little ahead of you, I think.
A little? Yeah, we can't even say the word spring right now without crying. So we'll stop right there. Well, you're a California boy. You've grown up in California your whole life, haven't you?
Well, yes. I was born in San Francisco and spent my first 6 or 7 years there and then moved to Marin County North. And now I'm living in Berkeley East. So I've lived mostly around San Francisco Bay all my life.
And that factors in quite a bit to your poetry.
Yeah. Yes, it gave me something to write about.
So you never ventured very far. Have you lived anywhere outside of that area?
Yeah, I have. I've lived, my first teaching job was in Buffalo, New York, and at the State University of New York, which was culture shock for me. And I spent 4 years there, where there is serious snow and serious winters, Great Lakes climate. And over the years, I've lived in England and in Germany, in Berlin for half a year, in Paris for shorter periods of time. I've taught at the University of Iowa, so in the last few years, my wife and I have spent 2 or 3 years all together a visit to Iowa City. So I also have lived through Midwestern winters.
You know what it's like then.
And what else? Where else? I did taught for a semester at the University of Virginia back in the 70s, so I got some of the sweetness of a northerly part of the South spring.
Okay, nice. Well, my mom, who is co-hosting today, is from Tennessee. So
part of Tennessee?
I'm from East Tennessee, around Knoxville and Oak Ridge, Tennessee, in God's country.
Yeah. I've just been reading the letters of William Styron. I guess he grew up near Knoxville.
My mom had a great literary teacher when she was young. What was his name, Mom?
George Scarborough. Have you ever heard of him?
I sure have.
Well, he was my high school senior class teacher.
Oh, my.
And it was college preparatory English. And I didn't really know how great he was until later. I wish I had recognized that when I was 17.
Of course, we don't at that age know what's going on at all.
That's right.
I'm just looking. I have his collected poems, but not here.
Wow.
I have another little shack study out on the coast where I write, and I have my George Scarborough out there.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. So you know who he is.
I sure do.
Well, Mr. Scarborough, we called him Mr. Scarborough. And I think he was a hidden treasure back there, you know, but it seems that he was one of the great poets.
Yeah, I think it was the poet Donald Revell who introduced, told me about George Scarborough, and then I think he gave me actually as a gift his collected poems a few years ago, which had just come out, and I had never heard of him at the time in the way that, you know, there's an extent at least to which American poetry, American literature is very regional, and so, you know, I read the California writers out of curiosity to see what people made of my world, but I didn't know much about Southern writing.
Well, this was way back in 1962,
yeah.
So it's a long time ago, but he lived to be a very old man into his 90s.
Yeah. Of course, 1962 doesn't seem that long ago to me.
No.
Well, it seems a long time ago to me because I wasn't born then. But I don't know, there wasn't really a 1962, was there? I think life started in 67.
There's a poem by Philip Larkin. I think the first line is, sex was invented in 1962.
Oh, really?
Of course it was. Because was he conceived that year?
That was his response to the 60s.
Well, Bob, you said that poetry is regional, and I am curious about what, because since you're from California, the San Francisco area, how did you start as a poet? What were your early influences, and when did you think of yourself that way or see yourself branching off that direction?
Well, I've given different answers to that question over the years, and when I've looked at interviews I've done, I thought, now, what's the truth of this matter? I in high school, my older, the Beat thing was happening. When I was in high school, the Beat Generation, as they were calling themselves, got invented in North Beach in San Francisco. And the older brothers and sisters who were in college of my high school friends, some of them were, you know, on that scene. That is, or at least they went around wearing jeans, blue work shirts bought at JCPenney's, which were a kind of emblem of the civil rights movement, black turtlenecks, sandals. The guys started growing scraggly goatees. Women wear black leotards and dance skirts. And they looked cool. And I knew that poetry was associated with it. When I was in high school, there was newspaper stories about this book being prosecuted for obscenity, Allen Ginsberg's Howl. So, of course, we all ran out to try to find it.
Yeah, there's no better way to make sure a book gets read.
So I was aware of poetry, and my older brother was in college, and he was taking English courses. And I remember reading, especially the romantic poets, Wordsworth and Coleridge and Keats, out loud with him, Walt Whitman a little bit. And when I went to college, I vaguely wanted to write, and there were, in college, self-identified poets, and I didn't think of one. And in fact, I think I sent some effort at poetry and at short stories to the literary magazine, and the editor said, stick to fiction, kid.
Wow.
But, and you know, in college, so we were reading, going over to North Beach and trying to buy books, but I don't remember poets particularly. I did get a hold of Howl, and it was more or less unintelligible to me, having grown up in California in this little town that was turning into a suburb, kind of lyrically beautiful place, and reading Howl at that time.
Well,
Moloch, ash cans, unobtainable dollars, written out of a kind of what I think they used to call it, ash can realism of the 1930s and 40s, plus the surrealism. I didn't really get it at all. But I read some of Robinson Jeffers, who was writing in nature poetry down the coast, and I read, in college, I think the first poems to really hit me were by John Donne in it. Because they sounded like a voice speaking. I think there's a poem that begins, for God's sakes, hold your tongue and let me love. And I thought, cool, you can do that in poetry. That's amazing.
Okay. Bob, did you ever read sonnets from the Portuguese?
Sure.
Sonnets of the Portuguese or sonnets from the Portuguese by Browning, I believe.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I read them, but I certainly read the most famous one, How Do I Love Thee? Let Me Count the Ways.
Yes. I fell in love with poetry through that.
Yeah.
That was back in my teenage years.
Yeah. Poem full of great warmth and idealism and sweetness.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you first started writing poetry, did you try to mold yourself in the image of a poet that you respected? Or did you go with your own style right away?
You know, I think I kind of wrote some poems in college, but not very many. And I tried to write stories, and I fell in love with the essays of James Baldwin, with the era of the civil rights movement,
mm-hmm.
writing these just gorgeous personal essays. And he recommended the essays, talked about the essays of Albert Camus at the time. That was the other thing that everyone was supposed to be reading was Sartre and Camus. The existentialism was the currency in the way that postmodernism is now. And I read Camus' essays. And so in college, I thought really that there were three or four or five genres of writing. You could be a playwright. You could write philosophical, lyrical essays, personal essays. You could write poetry. You could write fiction. And I kind of tried my hand at various things.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of discovered modern poetry in those years. But anyway, I don't think I actually started writing poetry with any intensity until I was in graduate school. I went from undergraduate. I dropped out for a year and tried to write a novel, not very successfully. But I read a lot of poetry during that time. And when I went back to school, finished college and then went to graduate school, I started writing poetry, influenced a lot by Gary Snyder's poems, I think, and I was reading Robert Lowell at that time,
mm-hmm.
and Theodore Riske, that Randall Jarrell, Delmore Schwartz. So it was more or less just because I was not an English major in college. I just sort of read what fell into my hands.
You weren't an English major?
No. Wallace Stevens I read, and Robert Frost. Yes, you know, everyone read, you know, anybody who's interested in poetry practically knew by heart the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock.
Mm-hmm.
But one of Kerouac's stories begins, "We were young and cool and dug Pound and Miles." So I knew that you were supposed to be able to read Pound's cantos and also like Miles Davis. So
mm-hmm.
in that way, trying to, you know, having the elders tell you what's cool and trying to try it out and see if you mm-hmm. thought it was cool was part of my education.
I would walk deep into the darkest woods. You can find me, I'm dreaming here. And we would share the only water any.
So now your first book was Field Guide, or did you come back? Okay. That was your first collection. And right off the bat, you won the Yale Series of Younger Poets Award. That was a pretty big deal.
Yeah, was then.
Yeah, so how did that then, did that seem meant to you as a poet in your mind?
Yeah, well, it was quite amazing to me, actually. I mean, I had started writing poetry, and then I was getting a PhD in literature at Stanford. And in those days, we were very involved with the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement. We started a newspaper, graduate student newspaper, for the reform of the university. And I was with a couple of other people. I was one of the editors of it. So I was writing prose a lot and reading poetry. There was a very powerful and conservative poet and teacher at Stanford when I was there, Ivor Winters, who was a New Critic and wrote famous grumbly but really smart essays disapproving of modernism, disapproving of most experimental poetry. And my first class in graduate school, 10 weeks and quarter class, was his lecture course in the history of English poetry.
Hmm.
And I had never heard anybody talk so passionately about anything in my life. And I found him amazing and enthralling. I also disagreed with every third thing he said.
Yeah.
But And I didn't, and I thought he was scary, and I didn't go near him. But there were a group of of student poets at Stanford who were taking his creative writing classes. Robert Pinsky was one of them.
Oh, wow.
James McMichael, who's a poet who teaches at UC Irvine and has published many, many interesting books of poems. John Mathias, another of the poets of who's gone on to put together a body, interesting bodies of poetry, were the poets around Ivor Winters. And that wasn't my scene. I was involved with the political people. But I was aware of them, and I started writing poetry earnestly in those years.
Now, Field Guide doesn't come off as being political, but was it? Are some of those poems more political?
They were not especially. There are two or three poems that are directly about the Vietnam War, which was on our minds, or indirectly about it. So, yeah, I think they have, to some extent, have a historical sense in the poem called Palo Alto, the Marshes, that as it happened, the other thing that was happening to me in those days was I had babies. We had babies. I was married, and my very young son, and I would, in order to let my wife get some sleep, take out in the morning to the marshes on the edge of San Francisco Bay, and we'd walk and watch shorebirds. And I came to learn that a couple of things. One, that just north of where we walked was a Dow Chemical facility from which napalm was being shipped from where it was manufactured to Vietnam, and that the land on which the place I was walking and the Dow Chemical plant were had been owned early on by California rancheros who were displaced by Americans during the Bear Flag War, during when the United States grabbed California from Mexicans. So I try to write a poem about that, about present and past history.
Yeah, you did that very well.
So
that,
anyway.
That section there about the fish that are flapping around in the ninth section of Palo Alto, the marshes, was incredible. Yeah. It really captured the...
The flopping fish is an
account. I thought that was just a really good image.
John Fremont and Kit Carson's raid on the just around the time that stories were breaking about the burning of villages in Vietnam. There was a famous quotation from one of the generals who said we had to destroy the village in order to save it. I was reading about the early exploration of California and read that party sent out from Washington to scout out the possibility of instigating a rebellion of Yankees against the Mexicans in California was led by John Fremont, a colorful, vainglorious general, and by his scout, Kit Carson. And they, as they were coming through the Sierra Nevada Mountains, were harassed by some Native American young guys, and they went out as an expeditionary force to what they thought was the village they came from, and burned it to the ground. There's a description of it, a haunting description of it, actually, in Kit Carson's memoirs.
Oh, really?
And including the flopping fish. The people heard them coming and just fled, and they came into this village with of maybe 85, 90 people with fires still smoking in the hearth, and they had just brought in a load of salmon from the salmon run, a big wicker cart-like thing, and the fish were flopping there. And
interesting.
They burned the village to the ground.
Yeah, so, you caught that well. So, yeah, that I can see now that you've mentioned it, that I wasn't putting it together, the time frame that you wrote that and, you know, the connection to the Vietnam War. It's interesting.
Yeah. It was very much in my mind. And I know when I read that book now, I think, doesn't seem like, and it isn't about politics, nor did I know how to think about politics very well. But because you woke up every day to the headlines and to the sickening violence, a lot of the poems are just poems that kind of wondering, or I think they are, if I would like. I was just amazed at daily life.
Mm-hmm.
I loved being married. I loved the way small children move through the world. Spring seemed a miracle in that way that when you feel like you've landed on the outer shores of adult life, and it seemed very sweet.
Well, you talk about naming things a lot in here, and you do, in Field Guide. But then as you go into your next book, Praise, and following books, you start to talk a lot about how there are limits to what language can do.
Yeah.
Like there are limits to saying in language what the tree did. It is good sometimes for poetry to disenchant us.
Yeah.
And in your latest collection, you have one of the things he believed is that our poems could be better than our motives.
Yeah.
And it seems as if you start looking at some of the limitations of what language can do right after Field Guide.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true, or am I misreading?
Yeah, well, I know. I mean, it's true. I mean, and I do think Praise is a very different book from Field Guide in that way, in a couple of ways. My experience of it at the time was I was learning my world in some ways in my 20s when I was working on the poems in Field Guide. And I said this before, but and other California writers have talked about it, but when we were growing up, all the textbooks were published in New York and Boston. And so in our first and second and third and fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh grade readers, Jack and Jane always went out and played in the snow, or there were red barns and great heaps of fallen leaves to be raked and so on. It wasn't my landscape.
Right.
And in a way that gave me a subject in California. But I also was just interested in the outdoors and beginning to be interested in environmental thinking, and spent a certain amount of time just teaching myself as an escape from graduate school, teaching myself the natural history of the places where I live, learning the birds, learning the flowers, learning the trees.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And some of that, of course, from Gary Snyder's influence, but also from the influence of other regional writers. It seemed then that, you know, Robert Lowell had found a subject because he was from New England, and Frost did, and Faulkner from being in,
mm-hmm.
in the South, and the poet Charles Olson from Gloucester and so on.
That
place was was something to think about, and so that was that project in a way of Field Guide. And then I moved back to California, and I was in my early 30s, and I began for various reasons to feel in my own personal life the limitations of the ideas about poetry that I had inherited from my untutored reading. And a lot of the descriptive poem in Field Guide and their rhythms, their way of breathing, starting to seem limited or constricting,
mm-hmm.
to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Hemingway's influence on young men was immense, like the influence of cowboy movies was immense. That in Hemingway's stories and in his novels, the guys never said what they were feeling. They just described the world, and you were supposed to guess what they were feeling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was a kind of male, tight-lipped stoicism that was seemed admirable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was 28 or 29 at that point and had finally reached that place in a marriage where the person you're with says, talk to me. And I would look amazed and say, okay, what do you want to talk about?
Talk about it.
It wasn't that I didn't want to, I didn't even know if something was missing.
Right.
In a certain way. And as long as I was writing poems that went, I won't say much to the sea, except that it was almost the color of sour milk, the sun in that clear, unmenacing. And I was teaching myself to the rhythms of free verse by kind of putting down the words. Gary Snyder has an image, lay down these words like rocks before the mind, as if you were making a riprap, the word for a cobblestone trail in the Sierras, or mules not to slip on as they're going uphill. I was kind of building the road of the poem block by block, and I needed to find my way to more fluency. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think there are a couple of poems in praise that have kind of long breath open.
Well, are there any from that you have that you could read to us this morning? I don't know if you have your book. I have all your books in front of me.
Sure.
So I'll just hand you one across the table, okay?
if this is interesting, just the sense of contrast maybe between the kinds of breath and different rhythms of when I read some of the poems in Field Guide to myself, I can feel that young man's control.
Yes, absolutely.
Dreamed, mm-hmm. The beginning of Palo Alto, the Marshes, she dreamed, first of this opening line, it's an iambic pentameter line. She dreamed along the beaches of this coast, here where the tide rides in to desolate the sluggish margins of the bay, seagrass sheens copper into distances. Walking, I recite the hard, explosive names of birds, egret, killdeer, bittern, tern. Dull in the wind and early morning light, the striped shadows of the cattails twitch like nerves. So, you know, it's kind of strong stress, slow movement. It was a sound and a way of learning to write that I was, you know, in love with. And it felt to me like it was a language you could describe in, but you couldn't get really to the fluency either of thought or feeling very well from it.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the poems in praise.
Well, you also in praise you start using a haiku.
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, I was already. I would say praise has less of that. There are actually haiku translations in Field Guide, and haiku like. Images, you know, dull in the wind, the striped shadows of the cattails. That is that kind of intensity of observation is there. Let me just read a little bit of the beginning of a poem in praise called Against Botticelli. In the life we lead together, every paradise is lost. Nothing could be easier. Summer gathers new leaves to casual darkness. So few things we need to know. And the old wisdom shudder in us and grow slack like renunciation, like the melancholy beauty of giving it all up, like walking steadfast in the rhythms, winter light and summer dark, and the time for cutting furrows and the dance, so on. Or the beginning of meditation at Lagunitas, which has a more spoken tone. All the new thinking is about loss. In this, it resembles all the old thinking, the idea, for example, each particular erases the luminous clarity of a general idea, that the clown-faced woodpecker probing the dead sculpted trunk of that black birch is, by his presence, some tragic falling off from a first world of undivided light, so on. It, at least to my ear, it moves way more fluently than the poems
Oh, absolutely. And this is when you start to talk about the word as elegy, as soon as it's in that poem.
Yeah, and it has, I mean, I think it had to do with moving back to California. I was writing, when I was beginning to write poetry in Palo Alto, I was discovered California as a subject, and then I found myself in this other world entirely, in the Great Lakes, right on Lake Erie in Buffalo. It's an odd city. I've lived in Berlin and I've lived in Paris and London. And when I have dreams about exotic places, it's always Buffalo, New York. Because it was the first time I really lived in a new place and had to learn the new names of things. I didn't even have language for the kind of for architectural elaboration in Victorian houses in Buffalo. Let alone for the trees and the, you know, different words for different kinds of snowfall in that place where snow practically got invented. And so how did we come to that?
You came back to California from there.
Moving back to California, I thought, California felt like a utopian idea to me when I was living in Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got back, it was my daily life. So I found myself not thinking about the names of trees, but about the nature of dreaming and nature of desire. And that seemed to me in some way the subject of praise.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you can see there's then some liberty or freedom that occurs in you, and your poetry starts to really open up.
It starts to really...
Open up.
Open
I think.
Up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess.
And then when you get up to, like, Sun Under Wood, now at that point you're really delving into some personal, painful type issues. Like in your book of essays, What Light Can Do, you talk about families and prisons.
Yeah.
And one of your lines in there says, "In my early childhood, my mother was chronically alcoholic, which filled my days, or some of them, with instability, sorrow, and some terror. Also, and more problematic for a writer, a certain amount of amnesia." Now, it seems like the amnesia was wearing off by Sun Under Wood, and you were coming out like my mother's nipples. That's about as out there, you know, emotionally for a poet as you can get, talking about the most difficult subject matter, family, and then the most painful, you know, with your mother and her alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
So what occurred for you to be able to even go there and do that?
You know, it wasn't, I'm not sure I remember. I mean, I don't know that I know the answer to that question. I know that, I mean, of course, the possibility of the subject matter, of using one's own personal life as subject matter, was there for 20 years, because the kind of poetry that got called confessional, poems of Sylvia Plath about her father and about her marriage, the poems of Robert Lowell and Allen Ginsberg, Adrienne Rich's Diving into the Wreck, there were all kinds of, suddenly, starting, I guess, around 1956, there was a lot of autobiographical poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And autobiographical poetry about oneself and one's childhood, one's parents, one's marriage, personal relationships, stuff that usually up to that point got dealt with in poetry through some kind of fictional or mythic screen or other.
Mm-hmm.
Or as in the modernist poets, they spoke of masks or personae that Eliot could write through the person of Alfred J. Prufrock, and Pound through Hugh Sullivan Moberly. And
mm-hmm.
Yeats had several of these different invented persons that he wrote about who were aspects of his own personal problems, but you didn't, you know, he wasn't writing about his psychological relation to his father in direct ways. So
mm-hmm.
it was there, and it wasn't, it didn't present itself to me as subject matter, not because I was reluctant to talk about it, but because, for one thing, it felt like it was had already been done.
Mm-hmm.
And for another, I didn't know what I had to say about it that was of any use to anybody, or to myself even, for that matter. I mean, I was certainly spending a certain amount of time trying to figure out the way, as we all do, shaped by family and my parents, the way I was raised. So my main feeling when I found myself writing about my early childhood was, oh, God, everyone is just getting sick of is confessional poetry, and you're now starting to write autobiographical poems about you.
Good timing.
Yeah. But let's see, how did it happen? I was in a long first marriage, 23 years. It ended. I was in a new relationship that I was really very, very happy in and felt very lucky to have fallen into.
Mm-hmm.
And in the way that you do, rethink your life, I was, and especially your relation to women. Brenda Hillman, my beloved, then we weren't married yet, but we were up in the mountains, and we hiked every morning, jogged every morning, past a Catholic church up in this little ski lodge town in the summertime, and it was called Our Lady of the Snows. And running past it one day, I just remember going into the Catholic church in the little mission town San Rafael where I was raised, and lighting candles and praying for my mother's health and recovery. And suddenly I had a subject there.
Mm-hmm.
To somehow write about that child. And then, and of course Sharon has written endlessly about her childhood and written, you know, one entire book on her relation to her mother and her mother's death, one entire book on her relation to her father's death. She poetry was, as many poets of my generation were, they were let loose into a subject matter. Louise Glück's poems on her family, on her adolescent anorexia, Frank Bedard's poems about his tormented relationship with his mother, Robert Pinsky's History of My Heart, and so on. Even there, anyway, there was just a lot of poetry about that mm-hmm. subject. Mm-hmm. And I was standing around with Sharon, who was talking to a friend, a medical doctor, a professor of medicine, Michael Lieberman, who's also a poet, and he was complaining that he couldn't get going on his writing. And Sharon said to him flippantly, "Write a poem about your mother's nipples." And I overheard this thought, and I thought that's so typical of Sharon. So I went back and decided I was going to write a poem making fun of a poem about one's mother's nipples, and that was how I got started.
Mm-hmm. That turned out to be an amazing entrance into that whole life with your mom.
Yeah, and it gave a form to the poem, which was the form of all the forms of reluctance and defense that you go through in order to get to that subject matter. So, and I know from experience with people, it's not quite what you do with poems, but that one of the things about alcoholism and alcohol and addiction in families is that it makes it very hard for people to tell the truth about anything because of family, because of shame and secrecy and denial. And so lots of people over the years, hundreds have written to me about their experiences with that. So you know, sometimes it just does help to help other people.
Oh, absolutely. Did your mom read that poem?
No. As far as I know, she didn't read the poem. By the time, with both of those poems and with another poem, not sure if it's in that book, I think it is, but there's a poem called Dragonfly's Mating, which is actually has a somewhat cruel portrait of her in it. But she was pretty elderly and wasn't reading much, so I felt the magazines in which I was publishing poetry were so far from her world mm-hmm. that she was not in danger of hurt.
Well, that is a problem that's a problem for a lot of writers, you know, to write about familial relationships. Did you feel like if she would have read that, if she would have had a possibility of reading it, would you have been able to have written it?
I should say I don't know the answer to that question because I don't. Because I made that calculation, I did, and I'm not absolutely sure what kinds of self-censorship would have kicked in below the level of consciousness that I wouldn't have written it. I understood very well, and I think every poet has written poems that they just put in the drawer. For one reason or another, somebody, you know, might be hurt by what you've written, and so you don't need to publish it.
On the mountains, I heard you call, so I went running to collect them all. The gifts you showed me are your best parts. When I got there, all I saw was
blue. My mom has a question she told me about earlier. She wanted to ask you about the poems you put in your drawer.
Yeah.
Mom, do you want to...
I was just wondering if you keep all of your poems or if you ever just, you know, sort of get disgusted and you tear some of them up and you say, you know, this is just not good. I don't, you know, want to even think about this anymore. Or do you start something and if it you can't finish it, do you put it away somewhere? Or, you know, do you keep all of your material?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question, and I think about this all the time because I don't teach a lot of creative writing, but right now I am just starting a semester and I'm going to be teaching it, and over the years I have, and I think about kids in the computer, that they don't keep drafts. Everybody of my generation, and I'm sure most poets from the beginning of writing, which is 14th mm-hmm. century or something, made drafts of poems, and which meant that when you wanted to change them, you had to copy it over again.
Mm-hmm.
Which means, I think, when I finished Field Guide, because every time I made even a typo, I would be inclined to retype the poem entirely. I think I knew the whole book by heart by the time I'd finished it. Like,
wow.
Once you start working on a computer, where it's so easy to revise, it's difficult to save every revision, mm-hmm. each phase of the thing. Most writers don't, I think, anymore.
Right.
You'd either have to find a way to do that, which would be a terrific nuisance, to create a file of every single change you made. that's not quite the answer to your question. Yeah, I have a folder. I don't throw anything away. And sometimes, like, I don't think I've looked at any of my old folders in the last 3 years or 4 years. Other times, in order to get myself going, I have a huge folder of maybe a whole drawer that is not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Done, but not good enough. And mm-hmm. I have a whole folder of compost, just starts at things that didn't get going.
I was going to ask that, because when I've tried my hand at writing poetry, sometimes I'll have several lines, but I can't get any further than that.
Yeah.
And are you that way?
Yeah, that's money in the bank. What you do is you get up in the morning. I couldn't get up in the morning and say, you're a poet, write a poem, and look at a blank page. What I do is get out old notebooks and the pile of old drafts, unless I have, sometimes there'll be a line in my head or a thought, and I look at something and think, well, that's possible, and I get mm-hmm. going. But yes, I think no writer could function without this file of old stuff.
Your advice to other poets would be, don't throw anything away.
Don't throw anything away. And mm-hmm. keep the files at hand of stuff that you think is finished, you've done the best you can with, and it's not interesting. That when mm-hmm. I was a kid, young in my 20s, there weren't that many literary magazines in America, and there weren't that many books of poems published. I think you could, if you wanted to, read every book of poems that was published in a year. Now there are 1,300 or 1,400 mm-hmm. books of poems in English published every year. You couldn't possibly do it. Mm-hmm. There's an immense amount of poetry out there, and you can't keep up with all the voices and all the possibilities. Mm-hmm. And I would say that in relation to your question.
Just keep all your work.
Yeah, I think everybody needs to keep everything that they write, because you never know when some line or some idea, or is it seeking a home, has finally found its place. Some observation that turned itself into rhythmic language so that it felt like it could be alive. It might take you 20 years to find the poem in which it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Mm-hmm.
Linda, could I ask one more question?
Yeah, but we're getting towards the end of the interview, and I do want to ask Bob, too, if he has any poems he's working on right now that he could read to us.
Sure.
Okay, go ahead with that.
I wanted to see if there's any poems next. We only have about now, 2-3 minutes before we have to say goodbye. It just always goes so fast. It's ridiculous. I feel like I haven't even talked to you at all.
I know. The time went by fast. It's really been fun. Let's see. Of the poems that I'm working on, problem is, a couple of them are quite long. Well, would be a little bit of a process on this. These are things from this past summer with notebook writing that are now in the process of becoming poems. And one of them is called Nature Notes in the Morning, and it's like a bit like Field Guide in that it's made up of small bits. After days of wind, no wind. The leaves of the aspen are still, the leaves of the alder and cottonwood juddering for days and cold are still. The east side of the trees are limbed with light. Last night a stand of lodgepoles lit on the west side, a kind of symmetry in days, lit on the west side in the morning, lit on the east side in the afternoon, because they're standing still. Just distribution of economics, light everywhere. How do I know? What do I know from yesterday? The bluebell of the gentian on the trail, hawk moth swarming in the scree. Two drops of violet in a pool of azure is the color of the petal of the gentian. Cottonwood leaves lit by light, the rock face of the mountain gleaming. And only for a second yesterday, the tanager's yellow breast, as if the gift of life were excessive, I marked the gentian's location at a turn in the trail, left side going up, right side coming down, fern shading it, so I could find it. Inset cedar above it, two boulders of granite, mica flecked, and I still couldn't find it all the way back down. And then it takes a little leap because I saw one of the most amazing shows of paintings I'd ever seen in my life just before being in the mountains. Itoga Jakuchu smeared a paste of egg yolk and white paint on the backs of his scrolls and then crushed oyster shells to another paste and added carmine for the rooster's crest he painted into the soft silk. He smuggled Prussian blues from Europe against the shogun's embargo for the way that light looked on plums. Having value in the right place is becoming an outlaw to paint a plum with Prussian blue. List of colors to ban future kingdoms. Make a list here. Terra Verte, Alizarin, Lit, Carmine, Last Streaks of Sunset, Alizarin. And I thought of the old historian I knew as a kid. I was going on about Cezanne, and he took me into the studio and took down four tubes of shades of green and stood me in front of an easel with a brush and said, now, put these on paper in small rectangular daubs so that they shimmer. And until you can do that, I say this in all friendship, shut up about Cezanne. That was what Professor Henry Schaefer Simran, trained at the Bauhaus, escaped the Nazis in 1939. He wore bow ties and plaid shirts, wrote about perception. Big man, full of vitality, must be long dead. Bright sun, no wind. So that stirring in the cottonwood, judder in the leaf, must be a warbler. So that's the summer poem from last summer that I'm still working on.
It sounds done.
I hope it's nearly done. I didn't read the really totally awkward beginnings of the other poem.
Well, when do you find peace and say this one's done? It's ready. I mean, how does that? We're going to have to end, unfortunately, because we do have to go to another interview. But
yeah, how do you know when the interview is done?
Yeah, I know the interview is not done. That's the problem. Yeah. It's really hard to say goodbye in these interviews because an hour doesn't cut it.
Yeah. Well, we all just need to say a prayer to the gods of shape, which is how you know a poem is done.
Yeah, and do you ever think to yourself, I wish I could go back and after it's already published and redo that one?
I do, from time to time. Mm-hmm. You've watched, you know, there are famous examples of people who wrecked their poems by rewriting them, John Crow Ransom, Marianne Moore, but and so at a certain point you should obviously leave them alone. Leave them to the other person you were who wrote those poems. But,
that's right. That's right.
Well, Linda, we'll have to do this again.
Yeah, Bob, if you want to come to the family table, you're welcome at any time, because I feel like we, you know, just haven't touched the surface.
And thanks so much.
Well, thank you for coming on.
It was really fun. Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, you have fun today at your class. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And with a faint taste of cigarettes, you write a hallelujah song. And ain't it wonderful and feeling all right? So I tickle up your backbone, and I.